You're listening to Brisbane Line on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM, and I'm Elliot Rifkin. Did you know the Great Barrier Reef was almost mined for its coral as lime fertilizer for cane farmers? Are you aware of an unsung hero, John Boost, who was the architect in the activism campaigns to save the reef and prove the reef was alive, counter to the prevailing beliefs that the reef was just dead coral? I spoke with Sandal Hayes of the Friends of Ninny Rise, which was John Boost's Mission Beach home and the center for the inception of the Save the Reef movement. Hey Sandal, who are the Friends of Ninny Rise?
Friends of Ninny Rise was a group that formed some 8 years ago now. It's our role to look after Ninny Rise the house, but Ninny Rise the house isn't important without telling you the story of John Boost and how he and his cohorts helped save the Great Barrier Reef from lime mining, and subsequently from then was saving the whole of the Great Barrier Reef from destruction. We wouldn't have it today if it hadn't been for John Boost.
How does Save the Reef fit into this story? In the mid-60s, Save the Reef, it didn't exist. People didn't even have that slogan. Can you tell us a little bit about that first?
Yeah, sure. John was married to Alison. They were sitting on the veranda looking out to the Coral Sea in this beautiful part of far north Queensland. And she was reading the local paper and noticed there was an ad there for a local cane farmer to use Ellison Reef, considered a dead reef, which is out in the Coral Sea, where in Bingle Bay, which is part of Mission Beach, 2 hours south from Cairns, possibly one of the loveliest places that you could go. It's where the rainforest meets the sea. There's 14 kilometres of golden sand with islands offshore and a very laid-back tropical lifestyle. Certainly in 1959, when John bought the land, it was dirt then, to build the house. There was hardly any roads. There was no traffic. He was thinking he'd pursue his life as an artist. However, he was always passionate involved in local issues. When his wife told him there was an ad for lime mining at Ellison Reef, he knew well as a passionate diver that that wasn't the case.
For people, just to get some context, that was 1959, and we're also talking about this is all blooming around 1966-ish.
Yes.
So we had the Vietnam War, we had the anti-war protests beginning, just in general ecologist stuff. I was reading a little bit of a book that you lent me called The Reef, A Passionate History, which is easy reading, actually. Don't be put off by the big size of the book, okay? He was a good friend of Harold Holt. And in case people aren't aware, Harold Holt was a prime minister from around 1967-ish that disappeared by diving. He died. Can you tell us about his relationship and a little bit about Harold Holt?
Harold Holt and John actually went to school together and then to university, and they flattered together. So they had a very close personal relationship. Harold Holt went into politics, and John at that time was passionately involved in art, and he went to Monsalvat, which was an artist colony outside of Melbourne, and that's where he formed his ideas on sustainability and art practice.
And Monsalvat, was that sort of like 1920s Paris?
Monsalvat was a new expression at that stage in 1930s and 40s. Something as novel as having an art colony was a very new concept. It was about sustainable living and also the use of natural materials and so on. So it fitted into John's ethos very much. So that's where he learnt his building skills, which is evident here in Ninny Rise. He maintained his friendship with Harold Holt, and Harold and his wife Zara used to come to Mission Beach regularly to Madara Island, where John first lived, and then they bought their own home here in Bingle Bay. They were passionate divers, and so the four of them, John and Alison and Harold and Zara, were diving often. Therefore, they knew full well any reef has got a mixture of corals that are dying off as the new ones begin. It's a natural process. The reef was well and truly alive. This farmer wanted to have Ellison Reef declared dead because it meant that it was fertilizer for his cane farm, and it was a practice that had been done many, many times. John raised the alarm in 1967 and took direct action to get a court order against this action. It was a very drawn-out process.
It's really hard for people possibly now to comprehend that the general general public would have thought Carl is just rock and dead. Would that have been a thought process in the 30s
well,
and 40s?
I'm not even sure, Elliot. I think it's more that people didn't know about the reef. There was no reef tourism. It was not on the radar at all, unless you lived in far north Queensland, had a boat and, you know, were able to access it. Or, in fact, down near Lady Elliot Island, near Brisbane, where the reef is also accessible. It wasn't part of the national psyche. It was brought to the attention of the national psyche by the fight that John began in 1967. Now, he had some heavy hitters working with him, most particularly Judith Wright, who is Australia's leading poet and possibly would still be seen as one of the most influential. She was a passionate advocate for Indigenous rights, for nature conservation, and she founded the very first Queensland Preservation Society.
We have a Judith Wright Centre in Brisbane, and most of us don't really know that she was an ecologist as well.
Right, yeah, well, she was all things. She was a highly, highly intelligent woman. Not a skilled orator. She was actually very hard of hearing, but her intellect was supreme. She wrote wonderful prose and also took up causes for the natural world. And when John Buist wrote to her from his home here at Ninny Rise, she immediately took on the cause. Len Webb was the other of the trio, who was a scientist at CSIRO and probably one of the very first ecologists who studied the rainforest.
From that book that I read, this trio, they were very different personality types. John apparently really took a lot of pride in being called a bastard. He didn't believe necessarily in democratic ways, and he just figured it's not going to be here, and he just wanted to barrel through. And Judith was very much into being sensitive. And so it's not that they necessarily clash. I guess that's a good thing to have together, to have one person that's finding the blind spot of sensitivity and the other person making sure that you're moving forward.
Right. Okay. Well, that's really an interesting take on it. I think that in this case, Judith Wright's book, which is Coral Battleground, which is really an activist manifesto on how to run a campaign. So unlike many of her other books and poetry, this stands alone as a really great example. So it actually does, from beginning to end, go through the process of how this battle was won. So she was very pragmatic in this case. She admired John very much for his aesthetic ability as well as his practical skills in getting the attention of politicians and the intelligentsia. And he came from a privileged background himself. He was really at university to study law. However, he dropped out and became an artist. But he still maintained his friendships and he used them to great effect in all the correspondence. Probably one of the things that stands out most is that his powers of persuasion were extraordinary. He wrote 4,000 letters on an old typewriter. His secretary also helped, and Alison wrote some letters, but mainly it was John. And he was writing to the unions, the different political parties in Australia, the UN, right across the board worldwide. You did ask where did the Save the Reef campaign come from?
Yes.
That was the slogan that was adopted somewhat later than during the time of John. He died before the battle was won in 1971. The reef and the rainforest were not listed as wet tropics heritage sites until the mid-80s.
I saw also in the book that it said that besides him being, I guess, tenacious, as he was friends with the Prime Minister Harold Holt, he would stalk these people until he got to be able to talk to him.
After Harold died, or was lost at sea at Cheviot Beach in Victoria, John redoubled his efforts despite his sadness, very profound sadness, and he knew that John Gorton was going to be on Dunk Island. John Gorton was the following Prime Minister of Australia after Harold Holt. And so he pursued him, and after a four-hour meeting, he convinced John Gorton that he would also follow in the path of trying to save the reef. And having said this, it's really important to explain that once the Ellison Reef case had been judged in favour of that the reef was alive and that wasn't allowed to happen. During the course of the research, John, Len and Judith discovered that Joe Bjelke-Petersen, the Premier of Queensland at the time, had actually staked out mining leases, and they were bought by friends and cohorts up and down the length of the Great Barrier Reef.
And this wasn't for lime, this is for oil.
This is for oil, exactly. Had those leases been taken up, we would have never known the Great Barrier Reef at all. We would never never have known what it became, which was the lifeblood of Queensland tourism for decades, despite what it might be now, where it is in rapid decline due to climate change. But at that time, in 1967, it was in prime of health and absolutely beautiful. And as you know, it extends from down near Brisbane right up to Cooktown.
Can you explain a little bit more about that campaign on Ellison Reef? Because it seems like that's what started a lot of this.
Yeah, absolutely, Elliot. The campaign to save Ellison Reef from destruction through the limestone mining demonstrates how John's powerful influence in motivating people, his clever tactics and approach to liaising with high-level politicians featured right throughout his campaigning, and the unification of conservation groups really achieved positive outcomes. So once again, we're really indebted to him for bringing conservation out of the realm of tree huggers into the pragmatic world
of a respected science.
Precisely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly that. We are blessed with the only physical specimen that can be seen from space, and that might be different now with technology, but certainly back in the day, people have traveled all around the world to have an opportunity to marvel at what was called one of the seven wonders of the world. Now, none of that would have happened had John not continued the fight. Ellison was the beginning. The fight continued and grew in the amount of work and the people who were involved. And that's when the younger people, university, marine biologists, and across the board, people in Australia and around the world had the very first bumper sticker that said, "Save the Reef." It actually wasn't something that anybody had had before that.
In the 60s, the ecologists weren't really seen as a science discipline. It wasn't really studied very much. So Bjarke Petersen was easily able to get people from the States and whatnot to say that this is a resource we can use for oil. And there wasn't a way to have valid research to dispel that.
Yeah,
and there was no concept really of it's a living element that interacts with the land. And when you wipe out the land to grow crops, that topsoil goes into the ocean and hurts the reef and what the relationship is. This is all just beginning to be understood in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely true. Joe Bjelke Petersen, who was a very controversial character in his day.
But apparently his wife made very good pumpkin scones.
Apparently so. Yes. Yeah. That was the very beginning of marine science at that time. And it was the Institute of Marine Science that actually also helped John in his quest to get the reef protected. He sought advice from the University of Miami, actually. He found a young American scientist called Eddie Hegel, and it was Eddie who actually dove on Ellison Reef and provided all the samples that explained the scientific process of how the reef forms and reforms during the course of its natural cycle.
Also, they had a worldwide negative event that happened that actually worked out well for John and his trio. There was an oil slick in the UK.
Yes.
It's followed by one in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
It was shown all over TV. Can you tell us a little about it? People don't realize that there weren't oil slicks on TV or the birds being covered in oil and any of that until then.
Yeah, absolutely. It came as a terrible shock to the Australian audience because it had never been in their purview at the time. So to see the birds, tragedy of them dripping in oil, made them then understand more that this campaign that was driven by John Buist was on the doorstep, and the possibility was right there that this could happen. And so to prevent that, the activism really kind of kicked in at that point. We are extraordinarily blessed that today we have the reef at all, given the history and the opposition from the major parties and the science groups as well. Despite everything, this small band persevered and they won. And just to mention, Ninni Rise is a heritage listed house, and it's listed on the Queensland Heritage Register for John's actions in saving the Great Barrier Reef and the rainforest as well. He was very influential in making sure that the army, particularly back in the mid-60s, didn't continue to use the rainforest as an experimental ground for controversial, what do you say?
Oh, well, because the Vietnam War was going on.
Indeed.
And it had safe jungle.
Yes.
For army people to practice in.
That's exactly right, yeah. What they did was make everybody think that they had a part in owning the reef, that it belonged to Australia. So the Premier of Queensland and the Australian Prime Minister and the oil industry, they met their match with John Buist, Judith Wright and other conservationists. These people managed to convince the people of Australia that the reef belonged to them. They needed to stand up and fight for it.
We now have it listed as a World Heritage Site. I guess
yes.
That's the bottom line.
Well, it is. And the primary organisations that forced the issue were the Wildlife Preservation Society, and John formed his own branch up here.
And Judith was the one who began that
in Brisbane. And the Queensland Literal Society Society, which is now the Australian Marine Conservation Society. At the time, they were minor players, but they provided great assistance to John and those organisations when it was most needed.
I don't know if people in Brisbane know what a wet tropics is.
Goodness me. Having lived here for 40 years, I find that extraordinary. The wet tropics, which actually is defined as the area from Cooktown to past Mission Beach, is rainforest where the humidity is so high that it rains. And in Mission Beach, I can tell you, we can easily have 5 meters of rain in a wet season, which normally begins in November and ends around March. So during that time, locals know well to be prepared to just walk in the rain. It's not cold and it's still a lovely place to visit, particularly at Mission Beach. The biodiversity of animals, birds and habitats is extraordinary. In Mission Beach alone, we've got 7 different ecosystems. I'd suggest that if you go on to the Ninny Rise website, which is NINNEYRISE website, you can learn more about that there as well.
And I'll put that on our program page, as well as I saw that John has a citation in Wikipedia, so I'll put that link. Any other websites that you think that we should put on our program page for people?
No, because before we began Friends of Ninny Rise, there was no mention of John Buist in Wikipedia at all.
I have an interest in Hawaii, and they would have these red and yellow feathers in their capes, and they would have sticky stuff so the birds would land on it, pick a couple of feathers, and let the birds go. So there is no reason that conservationism can't live with resource use. There's a balance that can be struck.
Oh,
they're not, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even the most ardent conservationists would be of the opinion that there's got to be living side by side, which was what John's mantra was, and was actually put on his headstone, which Judith Wright wrote, which was, "Here lies John Buist, a lover of beauty who fought that man and nature would survive." So coexisting so that you protect as much as you can in a logical way, allowing for legitimate progress which isn't destructive or extractive, that works together. And that's always been the position of conservationists and Mission Beach from the time of E.J. Banfield, who wrote Confessions of a Beachcomber, who lived on Dunk Island. Up until today, there's been an unbroken line of conservationists working in the area of the wet tropics, particularly because of the high biodiversity. It's a beautiful place. The birds, the butterflies, the magnificent cassowary, the mahogany gliders, the range and depth of the amount of birds and mammals is incredible.
One of the reasons in the Reef Passionate History book, the chapter you asked me to read, is that John moved here was when he saw the color hues. Being an artist, he just couldn't not live here once he saw that. So just to underscore you were saying about how beautiful it is here.
Absolutely. Well, in actual fact, he was still living in Melbourne and he came up here and he went to Badara. Now, on Badara, there was another artist, Noel Wood, who was also from Melbourne and from the Montsalvat group. And when John got to Badara Island, which was in the early 39, he said, "This is the most beautiful place I've ever seen. The colours are superb. No more Melbourne for me." And then in the ensuing time, he was actually lived on Badara for 30 years before he moved to Bingle Bay. And one of the reasons why he moved from Badara in 1958-59 was because there were too many tourists going to Badara, which is very funny when you think of the amount of people that we currently have as the tourism boom continues.
I guess it's all relative, isn't it?
It is all relative, yeah, absolutely. He was an artist, and we have examples of his work. He was a wonderful craftsman and a brilliant builder. Even though he wanted to capture the colours of all different blues, he possibly didn't, compared to some other artists. And once he got into the role of activism, that consumed his life until his death. Prior to that, his craftsmanship, he made the most beautiful furniture out of bamboo. And this house here in Bingle Bay has bamboo ceilings, bamboo architraves, very intricate parquetry. It's a very big house and a big long veranda which faces out to the coral sea. You can't actually get anything better than the sound of the waves crashing on the rocks below at Bingle Bay.
The relationship between land and water. So when the farmers, and this is not a slam on farmers, because you can find a balance, are using fertilizer to grow their crops for us to eat, that effluence that goes down into the water can create an environment for, crown of thorns, yes.
Yeah.
And that's an unintended consequence, and they eat coral. And that wasn't even known back then.
No, it wasn't. And really, I'd have to say, the farming practices back in John's Day didn't understand the relationship between the water going out to sea and what happened to the reef out there. Unlike now, and there are very good farming practices and many examples of groups like Terrain NRN, which is a natural resource body, who work with farmers in the wet tropics to help them continue their farming practice with less fertilizer or reimagined ways of using it that doesn't contribute to the runoff into the reef. And as I said, with the type of rainfall we can get in the wet season, which can be 3 to 5 meters, you can imagine the volume that makes its way out to the reef.
And it's part of life here. It's just the way it is.
Well, it is. So the only thing to do is to
live with it.
Yeah, and pursue best practice in making sure that the farms use their fertilizers wisely and divert the runoff so it doesn't go to the reef. I'd suggest very much that looking up the natural resource management bodies in Queensland, they're undervalued, but certainly one of the most important bodies that we have. They're not quite government, they're independent. However, they do rely on government funding, and they're heavily involved in all the communities across the wet tropics in helping to protect the wet tropics as much as possible.
In general, this is a success story because we still have the reef to a good degree, even though it's still limping. Unfortunately, John did not see the success of his efforts.
No, he didn't. So we have his legacy, for which we are incredibly grateful. He's one of Queensland and Australia's unsung heroes. Through one of our members in the community here, he wrote the most wonderful document to see if John Buist could be put onto the Queensland Greats, which is every year is put out as a posthumous award. And sadly, it didn't achieve that, but it just shows that 50 years on, the John Buist literature and archives are rich with the testimony and the details of his achievements, but not to the wider audience. And thank you, Elliot, because this is an opportunity for many people to realise that John Buist was the architect that saved the Great Barrier Reef and established the first National Marine Park, which went on to be heritage listed worldwide.
Yeah, and thank you for chatting with me, Sandal.
It's certainly an opportunity to have the message of how important the early conservationists were. Eddie Hegel still lives in Brisbane, and we see him when we have conferences up here and have great admiration. He was a 23-year-old American back when he worked with John Buist in the early days. And I think John would be very proud of the fact that we're talking about him today.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you, John.
And that was Sandal Hayes of the Friends of Nini Rise, which was John Buist's Bingle Bay home and center for the inception of the Save the Reef movement.